This is Sarah Tolan Mee, and I'm sitting with Augusto Machado at his home on October 24th, 2016. This is Oral History 1 of 3 for the Actors Fund. Augusto, would you like to make your statement?
Yes, thank you. I am a pre-Stonewall Christopher Street queen who witnessed and participated with alternative theater downtown. And is that I've been very fortunate to be part of Ellen Stewart's La Mama community and family, and that she is my honorary mother, and that I'm one of her oldest surviving babies. And at this point of my life, I still don't know how to sing, dance, or act, but I perform. And actually, Augusto Machado did not exist until 1959, when I created another persona, which is Augusto Machado, sometimes AKA Anna Mae Wong Jr., among the soy sauce heiress, among other things. But the journey of downtown at this juncture in our point of history and liberation just coincides with actually gay liberation, which is so much part and nourished downtown theater, the Judson, La Mama, Theater of the New City, Theater Genesis, and it continued on through PS 122, Dixon Place, and what have you. So it's the LGBT community has been very much of this all-encompassing theater movement, which was sort of ostracized by downtown. I mean, downtown was ostracized by uptown because you had to be on Broadway, in quotes, underline, to be theater, the way the art world, which is part of our alternative downtown, was. You had to show at a gallery on Madison Avenue, and as a recourse, wonderful women decided that there's more to the art world than a few self-appointed men who decided who is included, which excluded women. And so very strong women started the alternative on 57th Street, and it continued on to make a little jump here to early Soho, when three strong women, Holly Solomon, Barbara Gladstone, and Paula Cooper, decided in this sort of industrial desolate part of downtown south of Houston is that they were going to show artists who they felt deserve some sort of recognition. And subsequently a whole movement came, and then the establishment, Leo Castelli was off Madison Avenue, and he came down to 420, and then his ex-wife Ileana Sonabin opened her gallery, and the establishment, the money trail is who is selling, and what was the movement of the times. Oh dear, am I beginning to sound academic? I think I am.
Not at all. And actually, it's so interesting to hear how you identify yourself with all these other people and organizations. And so I'd like you to tell me a little bit about right before you made that new identity change, or a little bit about your childhood and sort of formative years that led you to discover these arts.
Oh, that's a very good question. Well, before 1959, whatever my life was before, I know it existed, but I don't really acknowledge, because this rebirth was as a person of color. I mean, we are aware of how our society and so forth is. Also with Hollywood, identification is you are subconsciously brainwashed in public school with history, is that you're in or sharing another culture. But the thought was the public library was really my my education, you're left alone, and I could look at all the magazines. And one of the thing of having aspirations and wants and fantasy life, a very rich and full fantasy life, is I wanted to find out where I could belong. And one of the things in fashion magazines I saw in Europe is they had models of color. And in, I think, I'll call 1959, Macy's had sort of a little runway thing, and they were having a fashion show. And one of the models was Chyna Machado. And so I became Augusta Machado. And on my door, as you go out, you will see a picture, and she's still alive. And beauty knows no bounds. And that's one of the things, is you don't have to be of a certain race or so forth. And he also used North African models and Africans, Yves Saint Laurent and some of the others. And throughout Saint Laurent's whole career, he used women of color because the contrast of the colors against their skin look so good. So we use that as sort of a base, but being a street queen, way before cell phones and telephones, and you sort of had to have it, money to have a telephone or an apartment. And so one of the people's, some people of a different generation don't understand is how we shared or communicated. Street queens are on the street. You promenade along Christopher Street up to Greenwich or parts of Washington Square Park. And some people call it dishing or gossiping, but you're sharing of who's doing what and where and so on. And being aware of police tactics and what you can get away with or what clubs are being raided and so forth. And so with this sharing, queens came from other parts of town to sort of let their hair down because Greenwich Village was very loose or looser. And then in Washington Square Park, you can see a mixture of people. And you're of this period, you're very aware Greenwich Village had mixed race couples. You saw black and white couples, and there were clubs and so forth, whereas in other parts of town, you didn't. And sort of a psychological jump is when you went uptown to our definition, and it revolves around all the boroughs, is when you went to Times Square, you dressed up. And I remember when I was young, when you went even to a movie in Times Square, you had to have an economic class to go to the theater, is men wore three-piece suits and a hat. That was just the standard, and of a coat and so forth. And women dressed up and wore hats and gloves. And one of the things, as a dreamer, I used to window shop and go into department stores, and I would look in places like Schraff's restaurant and see the ladies sort of who lunch with a hat, and they put their gloves, and I eat what I think is very fancy, is a club sandwich. And oh boy, I thought, isn't that fabulous? And then afterwards, they would have a cigarette. Subsequently, I just saw the Diane Arbus show at the Met Broyer, and what she was documenting was a time capsule of Americana, which many photographers have at the time, and why people look back at sort of obscure photographers is what they're doing, they're documenting. And downtown, we had many photographers that documented a town. And Peter Hujar, who was very important documenting who really is downtown, that his work stands. And I was sort of a caregiver for him at the end. And he died. He was David Wojnarowicz. He was a mentor to him, and then a boyfriend, and so forth. And that Peter Hujar took over Jackie Curtis's apartment on 2nd Avenue and 12th Street, which was the Intermedia Theater, which is now a movieplex, and that after Peter died, David was able to take over to the end. But prior to that, Jackie Curtis, who is very important in my life, one of Andy Warhol's superstars, had that apartment, and her grandmother was Slugger Ann's. And Slugger Ann was a East Village character. She was called Slugger Ann's because way back when Dime a Dance Girls were on Times Square, there was a columnist called Walter Winchell. And he was very important in the media because this is a little before TV. And when he wrote something in the columns, it meant something. Also, when I was young, I think I counted at the newsstand 10 different newspapers. And Walter Winchell wrote, he dubbed her Slugger Ann because at the Dime a Dance Hall, they weren't prostitutes, is you buy tickets and you choose the women to dance with. And the hand was slipping below, you could below the waist, and she warned him, watch your hands, and he didn't, and so she slugged him and knocked him down, and subsequently the other women admired her, and she was standing her ground, and when Walter Winchell heard about that, he called her Slugger Ann, and she was sort of celebrity, and with that, she was a smart woman. She got together some money and opened a bar, and in the East Village, it was mainly working-class straight men who came and patronized the bar, and she was a fabulous character. She was Jackie Curtis's grandmother. Jackie Curtis is so important because when her mother died, she was raised by the grandmother and the aunt, and it thinking about old New York is, when I was young, is that New York each had its own neighborhoods and a way had their own manners and mores of what is done. And you had policemen who actually knew the neighborhood and patrolled. And the plus and minuses, yes, you make donations to the Benevolent Police Association, you give them a free lunch or what have you, but they knew the neighborhoods, and that neighborhoods like in the East Village, of first or second or third generation immigrants, or down near Little Italy and Chinatown, is your children could play on the block safely because there were always eyes. If they weren't widows, there were mothers, there were aunts or grandmothers looking out the window. And in Helen Levitt's photograph, she does sort of aerial views of children playing on the street, making chalk drawings, and boys playing stickball, is that your block was safe with your kids, and you stay on the block. And all that quality of neighborhoods post-war changed with white flight right after 45, when the GI Bill, and coincides with Robert Moses, who did the built the highways out to Long Island, and that accelerated white flight, and the GI Bill allowed all white subdivisions, and the GIs from war got a good mortgage and a good rate.
But, so where did you grow up?
Oh, I thank you. I grew up in Manhattan. I called Hell's Kitchen, and then it was sort of a derogatory term, Hell's Kitchen, and then people said no, blah, blah. And then now another gentrification generation of gays who left the Chelsea area went up, and it's called Helsey, to some in the LGBT community, but it's Clinton, and it just doesn't have that character. But jumping to that part of 8th Avenue going west is Hell's Kitchen, was a solid white working class neighborhood that had its strong Irish control. They're the majority. They man the polls, your Democrats, and the businesses. And part of 8th Avenue from 42nd was like had a Greek proprietors and so forth. But if you're a New Yorker, you really know racially how things work, and how if you went like north of 57th around Lincoln Center, and I'm old enough to remember, Lincoln Center was a mixed race, lower middle class. And somewhere along the line, the powers that be, coinciding with end of war and art and culture, the Rockefellers decided on Lincoln Center. So they cleared out this whole mixed race area, allegedly there were going to be other housing for them and so forth. And then Lincoln Center, which is 16 acres, and the Old Met, which I used to go to on 39th and Broadway, moved to Lincoln Center in 1966. And subsequently, the Avery Fisher Hall was done before. And for some reason is that instead of having one design, they had three different architects do Lincoln Center. And that's why there's, it's a little incongruous. And then money constraints, it was supposed to go across Amsterdam and have a longer plaza and so forth and so on. Well, I'm old enough to know that I heard Jane Jacobs speak. And so I've meandered from, well, I used to live in that area also, is that the transition of, and real estate and construction was always part of the New York game. And that when Lincoln Center defined itself more, there was acreage for so-called, in parentheses, underline, middle-class housing. Well, for native money or whatever the policy is, the extra acreage was sold to private real estate, and Lincoln Towers, which was so-called middle income, which was too luxurious, and other people who were all waiting and waiting, were on a tremendous list, and then they were offered to, this is one of the dynamics of politics, is you were offered a public housing in Harlem. You didn't take it. We offered it to you, didn't take it, so you're expunged from the list. You were offered housing. Like, I was on that list, I was offered out in Bed-Stuy before reclamation, and three places in Harlem, because they give you some options. And one of the real estate housing representative that I talked to said, "Sir, you have to come like 11:30 to our main office, and I will show you three apartments that are available." And I said, "Oh, it's very tight." So I go up to Harlem, and I don't expect too much. And we go from an office, and he said, "We have to walk quickly. If you see a group of young men or so in the play yard, we will walk around another way, because this is their territory, and you don't exit." And then we get in, all the front doors are broken, and there are groups of older Black and Latino people who sort of go out together and come together because it's not safe. And so they show me what is available, and one building, all the elevators are always broken, and you have to do the stairs. Well, you being offered an apartment that we can't walk up to the 10th floor or so. And okay, you refuse that one. Then I went to two others, it was on a lower floor, like a fifth floor, and I know I was younger, I could walk that, but there were bullet holes in the building, and the assistant manager said, well, you know, we mean to get that fixed, but there's so many other priorities. It's like the main thing is get the elevator, and things are breaking down. So that was off. And then he walked me to another place, and these buildings had living families, there were young people, and there were people who say, oh, I'm on a list to move, I've been here 10 years to transfer, and I happen to, and you can't go out at night, you can't leave your apartment, and so forth. And so that was one of the things of public housing. I did try for one near the Brooklyn Bridge, and I thought, well, this is okay, because they have mixed race, and there were Asians, and as we know that Asians are so vulnerable to crime because there's no defense. If you're a middle age or older, you just give them what they want and hope you won't be harmed. I went to that one near the bridge, and it seemed they keep the green, the garbage were picked up. It looked almost like a show public housing. I think, gee, this isn't so bad. And then the young man showing me said, oh, we're going to have to step in this building for a while. And there was some sort of gang activity. They didn't look, well, they just like teenagers, but apparently he knew something I didn't know, and I wasn't going to contradict him. And then he showed me an apartment, which is like a second or third, and it didn't seem so bad. Yes, it overlooked the garbage things and what have you. And then and people have been trying to pry the door. And and he said, we will replace the door, or you can pay to have the door replaced, as long as your lock works. You know, you should be okay. And that wasn't too encouraging. I mean, you have to be desperate. And then he happened to mention, now you're near sort of a lower floor, overlooking garbage, but on certain evenings, don't be all that noise and yelling and screaming, ignore them, because some of the sanitation workers in that area of a garage have cockfights for extra money, and people come from different parts of town. And somehow the instinct said, I'd rather, thank you very much. And then I refused another location. And subsequently, the East Village, or below south of Houston, was an area which was in flux. That I could find a place, or near Tompkins Square Park, and I still have the ads. The Village Voice had apartments for $24, $29, $40. Yes, they're walk-ups. You mind your own business. And if neighbors were, to me, a drug dealer is just a drug dealer. It's a job, a means to an end, and that they're trying to support themselves or their family. And drugs was mainly like a marijuana, and maybe cocaine was a little too expensive, but heroin. But in this, it's the better of two evils, and the transition of Jewish people moving out of the East Village in transition. Now, I will jump to, we're going back to theater world, is in 1961, I met Ellen Stewart. Now, here is a black woman who really isn't of the theater. She's in fashion, and La Mama's going into its 55th year. She believed, and that people had to express themselves. La Mama had to welcome all people, irregardless, and that's what she did. But when she was on 9th Street in a dirt basement, all the Eastern Europeans would call the police because there's a black woman on our block. and they're she's a prostitute because white men are coming and going. What she was doing is, it's mainly gay crowd, is she was making theater. And Harold Pinter actually came to this dirt sort of basement, and because Ellen had the pulse of what was happening, and Harold Pinter happened to be in New York, and something of his was had already been on Broadway, I believe, by that time, or he was known in London, and his woman agent was a cease and desist. Is you're doing a Harold Pinter play, a one-act play, and you didn't get the approval, and you're not paying royalties or anything. Well, for some reason, she brought Harold Pinter down, and he saw this dirt basement, and met Ellen, and she said, "Well, I'm do theater, and somebody wants to do this play," and he saw the circumstances. It's not going to be making any money, and no one's being cheated. So he allowed her to do one of his plays, and subsequently, she was able to go down to Second Avenue, like where things change due to the real estate. I could name a place, but it doesn't mean anything because there's a East Asian smoke shop, and above that, on the second floor, she had a theater. Then she moved to PS 122, which is next to the Orpheum, which is like the on the second floor. And subsequently is in the format of Sexual Revolution, what have you, Eleanor Lester and Roz Riegelson is two feminist lesbians. We're on the pulse of what's happening in America and in the movements of downtown theater, wrote an article about Jackie Curtis called Not a Boy, Not a Girl, Just Jackie Curtis. And it made the entertainment section on a Sunday and subsequently helped solidify and unify an acknowledgement, yes, downtown East Village exists. It's a counterculture. And Jackie Curtis isn't pretending to be a woman. She just dresses in drag, just like the Cockettes. Even if you have a beard, you're dressing up. It's just counterculture and so forth. And so it's an acknowledgement. And subsequently, due to press and so forth, is that La Mama was recognized, and it did the work of Lanford Wilson and so forth. Then it got a Rockefeller grant and so forth and
were you performing at this time? Or how did your involvement with La Mama begin?
That's a really good question, because I mentioned being a witness and participant. I was so blessed to see this alternative world that I could dwell in the imagination. And that by going to the Judson, which was very, the Judson Church did so much of happening as in dance and so forth, and were anti-war into all the movements, and then La Mama. But I met Joe Chino in 1959. Now, because of the cabaret law or what have you, is that it was a coffee shop, but he wanted some entertainment, which was against the law, and that he was gay, and there were some of his patrons in this espresso bar wanted to do little plays or something and express themselves. And so subsequently, the Chino happened, and you saw slices of not the middle class thing you would see in a drawing room comedy on Broadway. You saw actual expression of your life experience and your neighbors and downtown, and subsequently it was reflected back in the LGBT community and the anti-war and so forth. And so then later, Theater for the New Theater, Theater Genesis and all that. Subsequently, I had met all the people, but I had never thought that I could cross the footlights. I was just, I have to put an asterisk there, I had met Jack Smith, who's famous for Flaming Creature that went to the Supreme Court, but somehow my involvement with him and making movies or being photographed to me was like just a departure. It wasn't, he did do theater pieces, but it was, now it's called, he's the father of performance, is long pieces. We did a piece, which you never duplicate the thing, is you're supposed to start at 8, and then by 11, 10:30, 11, people were leaving, and he says, the real devotees of art would stay till 11:30 or 12, and that what is he doing? Doing installations, arrangements, playing records, or actually cooking. You can smell food. Or with the door open, he was taking a bath. But all is prep. And with the long view now is, Jack Smith actually did like a 24-hour pieces and weekend piece where people could come and go, but people didn't catch the idea because it was so early in the 60s, and that they thought that was insane. Is that you come into a loft, there's no curtain, there's makeshift chairs, and even for downtown people, is like, okay, looking at their watch, what time does it start? Well, it started when you walk in, it's your perception of what is. Jumping back is, somehow I didn't consider that. It's theater, and but it isn't quite what I had seen at the judge, where there was a start time. And so forth. It's more structured, but they announced, and there's a certain time it starts. And this is that area called downtown nonprofit theater. You believed in your peer group. There's no money. You got things from the street for your set, or you found cardboard. And you believe in your friends. I've written a play. It's only a half hour, but you want to come aboard and help. And subsequently, people help people, and then they help the others. And so there was a whole wave of these kinds of theater that structured and fed into, if you ever think of people saying, well, the Chino, the Judson, La Mama, a theater, gee, that's, you know, they're sort of like Broadway. I mean, they put ads, there's a start time, and you have to pay, you know, it isn't a dollar contribution or what have you. And there's always, if you think you're left, you're not left. There are people who are even far out further. So actually, jumping back, is Jackie Curtis, well, actually, well, she invited me to be in one of her big pieces, Vain Victory, The Vicissitudes of the Damned. And it was a 6-month rehearsal period with no pay. But Ellen Stewart gave them a loft on Great Jones Street to use. And it was more or less a gathering place to sort of rehearse, but to gather and chat and dish and experiment. And one of the times that Lily Tomlin and Jane Wagner came during this, I mean, it sort of spread from Texas, Kansas City and what have you, is you've got to go see one of Jackie Curtis's rehearsals. And people would say, oh my God, with no real sets and costumes, it's a an empty loft, but we may do. Sometimes we had drag, and people would say, It was so real. It was so spontaneous. Well, didn't they know we were improvising? And the themes changed, and so we never did the actual script of Vain Victory, although one of the members of Joan de Carle's Playhouse of the Ridiculous, which I was a member, did the first act in Tribeca before it was called Tribeca, and he actually wanted me to leave Jackie Curtis and do the original first act script because it ran like 2.5 hours the first act. I mean, in art, there isn't a bear of you've got to do X amount of time. It just sprawls. And I understood that from Jack Smith is it ends when it ends. And we did a piece near City Hall, and I think two people had fallen asleep, and that we finished like 4:30. I mean, Jack's concentration was so amazing, is that in stillness or in an effigy that was moving or walking. I mean, it just, when you see Noh Theater and Kazuo Nono, it's like, it is, there's a universal expression of whatever you believe in and concentrate and do is the art. And whether it takes 5, 6, 7 hours, Omar is, Jack was going to do it on his own terms. He did do 4 performances of Vain Victory. We started at La Mama. And then we went to WPA on the Bowery, and then where the Rod Rogers Theater is, downstairs, and then upstairs. And so, and there were 66 performances of Vain Victory, which is well recorded, and it parallels. I know I'm talking like I'm on speed, but I did do speed in the 60s. And why waste time on sleep when there's so much to do? Is during this time at the Chelsea Hotel, a young man from Santa Barbara, California moved in, and his name was Lance Loud. And subsequently through downtown, I had heard that this strange, there's a Channel 13 crew who is following an American family they were going to do 6, then 3, then they landed on the Louds. And during the course of this, as Lance Loud comes out, he comes to New York, goes to the Chelsea Hotel, and in one of them, he says, Jackie Curtis has a show at La Mama. The best drag queens of downtown are going to be in it, and he's going to take his mother. Well, Ellen Stewart wouldn't let the TV crew film the show. Well, you couldn't get in. It was so popular. But they filmed a sequence at the WPA when it had morphed into a Jackie Curtis a gala. And so subsequently, a year later, when it made the first reality show, Dissecting an American Family, our section is in the second chapter, is that this is a face and reality of an American family. They're upper middle class. They live in a nice home. It's suburban culture. They have a car. They do the best for their children. They're going to dance class and blah, blah, blah. And Lance sort of comes out. And so Lance was really very nice. And in that experience is that it didn't. It was just part of our journey with Jackie Curtis. And then Jackie was in a transition hiatus. And then I followed the Playhouse of the Ridiculous in the mid-60s. And that to me was a normal, chaotic theater. And all the bizarre people I knew in my life or in what have you, this is normal to me. And that's where I had met Jackie Curtis. Of course, I think Jackie was kicked out at that time. a Penny Arcade, and a bunch of other people. And I was talking, a Penny Arcade called me from, she's in Europe, and she's very popular in Europe, and she's going to come back November 16th. And on December 1st, she's going to be at St. Anne's. Now, her journey, just briefly, is, it's so amazing. She's been sort of a diva downtown since she was 16. And through the nature of downtown is she's been so early a feminist, independent, and she does things her way, and she doesn't kiss ass, and she doesn't do politics. And so through these decades, she's done the shows she wanted to do, and her early shows at PS 122 were quite enlightening about being raped and so forth, is that she was sharing her life experience in a theatrical form, and that downtown women in the day were listening to their own voices and seeing their life experience, like the Spider Women, Native American troupe, and that the spinoff, and on 4th Street, wow, Women's One World, I think that's, I should know, Lois Weaver and Peggy Shaw, they're famous now for Split Bridges, and they just finished something at La Mama, but they've been going, I think, 4 decades or so forth, but they're well known in Europe. And one of the things about the lesbian community is they are so supportive through all the decades, because this is their voice, this is their experience and their struggles as a woman who happened to be lesbians, and how they want to express themselves. And yes, they teach, a class at Sarah Lawrence, but they go to university in Europe and so forth. And so they've enlightened a whole women's community about you can make theater, it's you and your audience, and that explosion of what downtown helped create. And I'll just do a little aside, is what the Playhouse of the Ridiculous did for a couple of decades, it's later reflected or refined into what became Saturday Night Live. The most absurd and ridiculous things, exaggerated, is widely embraced and very accepted and accessible. But as in all sources, I feel this is a distant view, is what Jack Smith did was too far out in the very beginning of no beginning, no end. It's just, this is my show, or this is my weekend, and if I go out shopping or go to, go out and don't come out, the loft is open, you can just sit there and see the environment, or what a grand word is, installation. It's just like, oh, this is an installation. No, it's my apartment, this is how I live. Not really, all I sleep on a sleeping bag. It's in the bathtub, so we can have like breathing room. Being part of the community, of the audience, and into it. And I really do not feel that I sing, dance, or act. I perform. And though, if you look at my resume, I've been blessed to work with the most fabulous people in the world. And it was in our world, you don't audition, you get asked, and they've seen you and they want to include you. So it's community based, and I don't know why I feel I was so blessed, is I didn't actively go after these things, and I turned down so much because I just did not feel qualified. But when my friends Glenn Santiago and his husband John Hogue are really so supportive and have kept me going, that and help me get my full resume, is I can't believe through these decades I did all this. And Downtown Theater is ephemeral. You do 12 performers, you do X, Y, or Z, and union rules, sort of umbrella, is you can't do more than maybe 12, or you can say it's a preview or something. But it's not for profit. And yes, we've moved in economically, and La Mama has to pay rent and taxes, and you have people who help in lining, so they must get paid. But as people say about us, is you're so driven to perform that it doesn't matter if you get paid. And the thing is, we're doing the work of someone, and the benefits is the expression and realization of somebody had something to say. And if we look back on any of the scripts and what have you, and I've gone over some of the things, it I don't know, it means what it means, but I mean, 30, 40 years later is, don't look back, you keep going. And there's other projects and so forth. It's just do your thing. And that's what the survivors have continued to do. And I say I'm 39, but I mean, I have friends who've long retired but have to keep working because Social Security won't help them. But I feel like every day is a blessing, and I do feel that every day is a gift, and you learn something. And because I don't have the modern guess of the earbud, as I keep my eyes and ears open, I appreciate what's on the street, and sounds, and movements, and that New York, Jack Smith used to call Manhattan Treasure Island, because there was every neighborhood, there was the fashion district. I mean, to know, and the wholesale places around 34th and going up, is there were dozens and dozens of button stores and fabric stores. And if you want zippers, there was a dozen zipper places, and every part of fashion there was. And now it's diminished, and thank God for the East Asians who have fabric stores where you can still get fabrics at a very good price. And now they had to move into vertical buildings, but word spreads. It's real estate in the fashion district, and the full circle, as I knew people who started downtown and who had bought into former fashion buildings and were able to have enough for a down payment to be part of what was a fashion building where that did a sundry of things to do with fashion, and that they have to make do. But it's the struggle, and it's all part of life, and I cannot judge. All you do what you do and what you believe in, and I believe live and let live, and you just keep going one step in front of the others. And unfortunately, I'm not educated, and I don't articulate the full breadth of my experience. But you can get a little taste or texture of the experience. But if when they see some of this, and it's in constant change, they'll say, "Well, this won't be in house beautiful, but it's an accumulation." In the spring, I would sort of like to. One of my dearest friends is Cockette Rumi. She was one of the original 13 that started in San Francisco. that I just did a piece at the Judson in the season before we did Lincoln Center. Oh, we could only get together. We can't charge. And so it's like the original thought is free theater. It belongs to everyone. So at the Judson, they give a free meal on the first Wednesday of every month, and then we do the show. I do a show in October. And then we're looking for a place in April. And last year we were so lucky because she donated 40 boxes of accumulated memorabilia. And we're all of a certain age, and if health issues is that it's not going to end up in the dumpster, it has to go somewhere. And people were saying here in New York and in San Francisco, well, a Cockettes were from San Francisco, shouldn't it be at the San Francisco Museum or something? And the outlook was New York. Well, Hibiscus is from New York, and he helped start the concept, is that San Francisco doesn't have the space or the economics to house a Cockette collection. Lincoln Center does. And so she had 40 boxes of stuff, and then she added another 20, and she's accumulating another. And the man in charge is Doug somebody, who took over for two other people I used to know, Robert Taylor and Nancy Dickinson or what have you. It just seems like you reach a certain point, and in a blink of an eye, they're retired. I just saw them. And then if you say Cher is 70, and I mean, it happens. I'm not even sure of the holidays. Is they're selling Christmas cards already? We haven't had Halloween's next week, and Thanksgiving. Well, the accumulate. So using Rumi is hopefully through this project, and I promise to live 4 more years, is that we will do this, and I could rest easier knowing it's been sort of collated in a way, and someone in the future may be interested. What I think is interesting about the collection are scripts, even if it's a one page of scribble, it was a script of a project. And I think that's important in the creative process. And most of all, I have a snapshot collection. I'm not a photographer. I take snapshots. And I have documented my experience downtown. Unfortunately, through my many moves and through rain coming through, I lived on 4th Street, and the landlord wanted to empty the building, which he did, is he made holes in the roof, and so the rain came in and snow to the apartment above me, and then it came to my mom, and I had so many boxes of, I'm a clipper, as you see, there's articles, tear sheets and what have you, and visuals that I want, is that it rained on like 20, 30 boxes, and the floor actually leaned, not sort of sank a little, and that wall was the hallway. And so little by little, I drag, newspaper can be so heavy when it's wet, in bags at a time, not down to the garbage in front of my building, I would drag it to the corner. And so there's a lot of things I mentally think I still have, which don't exist anymore. But they're things I think do. Fortunately, the snapshots, what Joan Jeffries has said is, if I, with a sense in prodding, is if I could put the name of the people. Now, the rub is you reach a certain point of life, and due to AIDS, is a whole community and generation was wiped out. And recently I lost a few more friends, and they're the ones who, if I phone them, well, Penny Arcade phones me for certain phone numbers or what was the name of somebody. And somehow with Penny, my brain cells work and a name comes out. But there are times is, who can I call, is who's that poet that, you know, name an incident, and all the people that are in the snapshot are dead, and the person isn't quite sure. And when I make arrangements to show the snapshot, I said, you know, I know the person. I don't know the name, but I remember someone who is also gone. And parallel to that, Marlene Dietrich, she was in her 80s or so, and a recluse in Paris, a very intelligent, fabulous woman who spoke 5 languages and so forth, is one of the sad things about growing old is not having someone to talk to on the telephone and sort of recollect someone or an incident or a wonderful event, a New Year's, you know, in 1940, and all these people are gone.
But I understand for you especially, this whole community is part of your artistic practice. So this whole constellation of artists and social activists have partly made your career.
Well, I don't really think I have a career. I think I'm a participant and witness. And as we saw with our Day of the Dead, I mean, I just, these were friends. There's not someone I just worked with once, but actually interacted through the years. And so with the documentary, Jackie Curtis Superstar, I participated with that, and Beautiful Darling about Candy, and at the Holly Woodlawn Memorial, which a Penny Arcade was in charge of at La Mama, is I spoke, and with Taylor Mead at St. Mark's I spoke, and Marsha B. Johnson at the Methodist Church on 13th and 7th I spoke. So I just have been privileged to still be alive, to be able to speak about these people. Oh, I spoke at Jack Smith's too, but it's if you look at the resume, whatever the next time, if it's printed, it's just like there was never a scheme in life to do a perform, really. Is that I just wanted to be part of the participant of what was happening, and that it parallels sort of with gay liberation, but it was the LGBT community as part of downtown expression that continued into these existing theaters that still thrive. And God bless Everett Quinton, who was Charles Ludlam's partner. I don't think they officially married, and I just saw him the other day. Is he continued the ridiculous 10 years after, and he had his service at St. Anthony on 7th, and I guess it's Waverly, where Peter Hujar actually did. I was one of his pallbearers. That there are people in our community, slightly older than, who thought that out of respect for Charles Ludlam and the Ridiculous Theatrical Company, which came out of John McCarroll's playhouse, The Ridiculous, with the Tavell brothers, Ronnie and Harvey, is that the theater should cease and it would become a legend. But Everett kept it going for 10 many years, which means another generation of actors continued. And God bless Black Eyed Susan. She is continuing since she came to New York City. She works with Marvel Mimes, John Jezrin. She continues to originate roles since she came in the mid-60s. And she's hanging on, living. Yes, she has to do a day job. She lives in Westbeth, what ain't cheap. And it's not my place to mention rents there. Or this fabulous artist that I met at the Pyramid Club, who Peter Hujar thought was fabulous and put him on the cover of one of his photo books, John Kelly, who is acknowledged it's right. It took him, what, 14 years to get into Manhattan Plaza. And I like Manhattan Plaza. It has an elevator. It has security. And I'm not sure if it has electricity or gas is included. But, I mean, I remember when that was all a vacant lot. And that part of 42nd Street was very dangerous. And they had to beg people, once the building was completed, to move in. And one of the people I knew from the Judson, David Summers, who had a career as a, he did El Carmine musicals, is Manhattan Plaza management was so desperate for people to move in there. It's flippant, but people felt so unsafe. Like, how do you get there? You got to cross 42nd Street or worse, 43rd Street, where it was so dark. Is that David Summers was offered, okay, you're single, you're only allowed a studio, but we will give you a one bedroom. Will you move in? And he moved in, and I saw his apartment. What anything modern and new, it's like, my God, this is out of a movie. And he had a view of the Empire State Building, and he was very happy. He had a light friendship with Tennessee Williams. Tennessee Williams had an apartment early in Manhattan Plaza. Remember, his career was in flux, and they accepted playwrights and Broadway people for matinees. They could have an apartment, take a nap on matinee days, Wednesday and Saturdays and so forth. But I mean, that subsequently changed, but they were so desperate. God bless David Summers, just a wonderful young man. And he kept little letters and things that he treasured from Tennessee Williams as a fan. I think the instinct is, where do we hide things? Or where do we preserve? He had a piano bench. He had an upright piano. And the piano bench was so thin. Well, for me, everyone says they know, is that he kept the letters in some cheap music in the seat of the piano bench. To me, I think that's a perfect hiding place. But how would you know there are things there? But apparently people who have piano benches or have a piano, that's where you keep cheap music. Well, I just thought that, like, no one will ever find that. And I know his boyfriend, Sal Licata. David's memorial was at Redden's on 14th Street across from Our Lady of Guadalupe, which was used to be, when it was an Irish neighborhood in that part of Chelsea, it was called St. Bartholomew. And there were AIDS had happened or was continue to happen. And I did see people, I was in the chorus at the Judson. I still can't sing. And I moved my mouth sometimes when I wasn't sure of the lyrics. But I mean, as a chorus, people think you're singing. I just make noise. But there were a few people I seen from the past. But this panorama of where my arc had been is with all the groups of people. I just thought, gee, wow. Just wow, and I'm continuing on.
Wow.
Somehow.
Thank you so much. And next time, I would love to go through the resume and talk more specifically about each project.
Oh, yes. With it written down, mind can connect.
Yeah, and this is a wonderful context in all these stories about these amazing individuals. Thank you so much.
Oh, yeah, but it's just babbling. You know, in the 80s, I did pieces where I'd get sort of a stretch, and then I'd start talking. And it really, I'd go on a detour, and that never come back to a certain thing, but that's sort of what I do.
It can seem to be a continuation of your practice.
Oh, yes. and in wonderment and in astonishment that I've just been so blessed to work and know with all these people. And I believe in the afterlife and that I will see them all again.
Well, thank you for being here.
Oh, Sarah, this is such a treat.